Chapter 6 The Messenger of the Great White Brotherhood. The prospect of seeing our old friend Gaylor delighted us, for his friendship with both was one of long standing and it formed a sort of inner tie. Rayburn and I felt his visit was to be of great importance. Mr. Gaylord arrived at 11 o'clock the following morning, greeted us cordially, and as I was about to thank him for having brought me in touch with the Rayburns, he looked into my eyes steadily and remarked, "You have our beloved master to thank." "You know Saint Germain, then?" I asked. "Yes," he answered, "I have known him and been under his direction in specific matters for some 10 years. He is drawing certain of his students together for important work that is to begin this year. This concerns a very serious crisis affecting the entire world, and especially North America. Yet it is possible that certain things can be averted, and if they are, the world at large will never know the vicious danger that threatens and the overwhelming disaster that it will have escaped. There is a certain sinister force at work within the atmosphere of Earth that is trying to destroy the beautiful Christ light which is growing like a flower in the hearts of more than 60% of humanity. The greater portion is in America, but there are many in all nationalities." We went into the house where Gaylord greeted Rex and Nada as if they were his own children, and was then presented to Pearl. "May I be excused?" he asked immediately. "I have matters of a private nature to discuss with your father, and will you, indicating me, remain within call?" In about an hour I joined them, and it was then I realized how important his visit really was. When we were seated, Mr. Gaylord revealed some of his activity as a secret messenger of the Great White Brotherhood, and presented his credentials. His work in this capacity had extended over a period of 7 years. He had his own avenues of personal contact with some of the higher officials and diplomatic circles in Washington, as well as many other places of importance. It is because of his personal influence in these channels that he was able to be of such great assistance to the Brotherhood when need arose. "Saint Germain," Mr. Gaylord began, "is concerned with certain activities in Washington at the present time. It is his request that we three reach there the 2nd of October, and he will meet us on our arrival. He says it is possible to use you, glancing in my direction, in certain ways which he cannot do with his other students, a slight example of which you both experienced when the attempt was made on Mr. Rayburn's life. Remember always," he went on, directing his conversation directly to me, "that our eternal motto and rule of conduct is to know, to dare, to do, and to be silent. Your trust in your own mighty I Am presence may be severely tried within the next few months, but you must realize that the messengers of the great ascended masters may only make themselves known at the right time, which moment those in charge of the activity decree." With a few more personal directions to me, the meeting was over. After dinner, Rayburn and Gaylord went to the tower room. We met again at breakfast the next morning, and I learned that they had both been present at an important council of the ascended masters in Arabia. Rayburn, with Mr. Gaylord's assistance, was unable to go forth in his finer body, while their physical bodies remained undisturbed and protected in the sacred chamber. As Mr. Gaylord was leaving, he remarked, "I am glad you have all entered the pathway of light, for there alone will you find permanent happiness. Henceforth, we shall meet often at the most unexpected times and places, for from now on distance will be no barrier for any of us." He said goodbye, entered his car, and waving his hand was gone. "How long have you been aware that Mr. Gaylord knew and was under the direction of Saint Germain?" I asked Rayburn. "About 4 years," he replied. "While I had known Gaylord a long time, it was only now that I was beginning to see the real magnificence and inner character of the man. In referring to this later with Saint Germain, he said, 'Little do people realize how often they are in close contact with greatly illumined souls, who are many times messengers of the ascended masters, but are totally unaware of it until some unusual event opens the door and causes them to reveal the great inner light. One might live for months or years under the same roof with a messenger and not know him until some crisis arose that caused him to reveal his power. The young people left for school the next day, and Bob returned to the ranch with us to receive directions from Mr. Rayburn about the work at the mine and orders to be ready to return early the following morning. That evening, we three had a quiet, confidential talk that revealed still more of the nobleness of Bob's character. Arrangements were made for him to come to Washington, D.C. at Christmas time for the meeting with St. Germain. Rayburn and I had many enjoyable evenings discussing the instructions St. Germain had given us. One evening, about a week after Bob had left, we were deep in the study of re-embodiment, when Rayburn read to me some of the material on this subject which St. Germain had given him. I quote it exactly. "If human beings only understood that human embodiment upon this earth is an opportunity given the personal self by the great law of balance to correct the mistakes made in previous lives, they would use every experience and extract the lesson from it instead of rebelling against circumstance and being used by it. This constant return to physical embodiment or garments of flesh would be an endless circle of cause and effect if it were not that man has the presence of God within him. This part of you which says, 'I am,' is the life, the intelligence, and the power that moves through your physical body. When the discordant habits of the atomic consciousness of your physical body build to such a momentum that the light of the mighty I am presence is no longer allowed to expand, and through that maintain the fulfillment of a constructive plan of life, the master self begins to decrease its supply of energy and eventually withdraws. There is only one thing that ever causes what the world calls death, and that is the lack of enough liquid light within the nerve channels. It radiates the cohesive power which holds the atoms together that make up the flesh body. This liquid light is owned by and comes only from the mighty I am presence of the universe. The outer garment is the receptacle into which this presence pours its light for a constructive purpose and use only. When that purpose is continually interfered with, the light is withdrawn, and the flesh body, which should be the temple of the Most High Living God, disintegrates. The experience called death is a constant reproof to mankind and a reminder to the personal self of its disobedience to the original God plan, the divine way of life. If the student really wants to know the truth about re-embodiment and life, he must go to the source of life, the mighty I am presence, and study there, for only as he receives wisdom from his all-knowing mind will he ever be its light. We may have mental concepts and ideas by the thousands, but unless we have become one with a thing through feeling it, we never really know. To gather facts from the world of sense and form, or the outer activity of the mind, is but accretion. Eternal truth, law, and intelligence come only from the mighty I am presence, the light of the universe. If one desires to prove to himself the truth of re-embodiment, that proof can only come from his own actual experiences revealed to him by his own God self. No amount of argument or phenomena will ever be proof to anyone. To the one who wishes to have this proof, I give the following, and it is infallible, for the ascended masters have attained their perfection of the ascended state by its use, and others may do likewise if they so choose. If the student with unyielding determination will acknowledge and accept his mighty I am presence, call to it constantly and sincerely reach up to it, love it and be grateful for its wondrous life which he is using every moment, waking and sleeping, he will cause his outer consciousness to be so raised that he will know, see, and experience firsthand the answer to every question and every problem confronting him. The greatest and most important activity of life is love, devotion, and gratitude to life, for all life gives us. As our outer consciousness becomes lifted by being held in constant adoration upon the mighty I Am Presence and continual acknowledgement given only to the perfection of life, all human habits and miscreations disappear, and we express only light. This is the ascended master consciousness. The outer activity of the mind and physical body becomes the visible, tangible form of whatever we think and feel. Man becomes that upon which his attention rests. If he meditate upon the mighty I Am Presence, he will become the full outpouring of that perfection. And if he spend his time and energy through his attention upon the appetites of the physical body, trying to satisfy their insatiable demands, he destroys his temple. No man may say him nay, no matter what his choice. The responsibility of his choice is unescapable, for it is inherent within free will. The paramount command of the Eternal is, be ye perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. For life will return you the individual consciousness again, again, and again, into human embodiment, until you fulfill that supreme edict of life. When that decree is obeyed, we shall find the manifestations of the constructive way of life have become immortal. The cosmic activity and light from our earth is being expanded at this time. Many feel this greatly increased energy, and unless it is used in a constructive way, the individual qualifies it with his own feelings of irritation and resentment against persons, places, and conditions. This but creates greater turmoil in his own mind and body, which constantly disturbs himself and others. During the present expansion of the light throughout the earth, it is absolutely imperative for the individual to keep an iron control over his own thought, feeling, and spoken word, compelling them to be constructive and giving recognition to nothing else, if he is to avoid continual distress and countless loss to himself and his world. At no time in the history of the planet has this been so important as it is at the present moment. The earth is passing through the throes of a tremendous new birth, and in the few years just ahead will be in a transition period, for it is changing now in a cosmic way from the attitude of war into that of peace, from hatred to love, from selfishness to unselfishness, and into the full recognition that in the future the people must exert strength enough to live according to the law of love. The hour strikes in the evolution of every planet and its humanity when they must express the full peace, harmony, perfection, and the divine plan of the system to which they belong. When that hour strikes, humanity either moves forward and fulfills that plan, or whatever portion will not come into alignment with the new activity removes itself to another schoolroom of the universe until those personalities learn obedience to life. The law of life is heaven, peace, harmony, and love to every created thing. Even the ethers of infinite space express this harmony everywhere. Human beings are the only creators of hell. They can accept and obey the law of life and enjoy every good thing of the kingdom, or they can disobey that law and be broken as a reed before the storm by their own self-generated discord. Each individual carries his own heaven or hell with him every moment, for these are but the results of mental and emotional states which the individual has created because of his own attitude. There is no other cause for them. Over the humanly generated chaos of the past, there are being poured out by the ascended masters and great cosmic messengers great streams of love and harmony upon which peace depends. Mankind, having so long pulled against the great cosmic current of love, which ever seeks to bless, is now being compelled to turn around and seek the light in order to survive in the midst of its own destructive emanations of the past. The constant command of the Ascended Masters is, let the great light of the mighty I Am Presence enfold the humanity of Earth quickly, that its sufferings may cease. Misery, darkness, and ignorance exist only because of lack of love. Mr. Rayburn and I were the only two left at the ranch for the next few weeks. We received splendid letters from Nada and Rex, and occasionally one from Pearl. They were deeply grateful to Saint Germain for the beautiful apartment which he and his love had provided for them, and among its many blessings were two of his other students who acted in the capacity of chef and maid. They had come from Arabia, and while in their activity as servants were the very essence of loving help. When the 24th of September arrived, Rayburn and I made a visit to the mine for the last time before leaving for Washington. The trip was beautiful, and we felt tangibly the overshadowing power of the magic presence which filled us with unspeakable joy and happiness. We found Bob expecting us, as Saint Germain had left him a message saying we were to arrive that evening. Mr. Rayburn's purpose in coming at this time was to contact the men more closely and give a radiation that would bless all. He spoke to the three shifts as they came off duty, telling them of the new superintendent, Dave Sutherland. They deeply appreciated Rayburn's kindness and generosity to them, and as he thanked and encouraged them in their work, he seemed more like a brother than an employer. I never cease to marvel at the power of love to bless men and their business, and they really accept and live it. Rayburn was a living proof of its efficiency and wisdom in the practical daily experience of the business world. That evening, Rayburn spent much time telling Bob many things Saint Germain had revealed to him during their hours of instruction. Bob was as happy as a schoolboy, deeply grateful for all he received. The next morning, we three said goodbye with hearts full of love. Rayburn and I reached the ranch after an uneventful trip and retired early. The following morning, he suggested we take the beautiful Arabian horse out for exercise, that I might see the part of the ranch that lay among the foothills. He asked me to ride Pegasus, and as the groom led the horse out, he broke away and came to me at full speed, rubbing his nose against me, as though to express his joy at not being forgotten. Rayburn mounted the black horse belonging to Rex, and we cantered off. We were returning along the foothills when suddenly Pegasus planted his feet and would not move. Let him have his own way, explained Rayburn. He knows a rattlesnake is near. Give him the reins, and then watch. He moved a short distance forward very slowly, and then stopped. We distinctly heard the rattle, and looking a short distance away saw a huge rattlesnake. Don't touch the reins, warned Rayburn. You will see a very unusual thing. Raising his right foot, Pegasus began to strike at the snake slowly, at the same time watching it closely. Suddenly the snake struck, and quick as a flash down came Pegasus' foot on its head, severing it from the body completely. I hugged him. I couldn't help it. But he was quite calm. I dismounted to get the rattles and found there were 12. You had better give me those rattles, said Rayburn. Pegasus will never let you carry them on him. He has a violent antipathy to them. The next morning we left for Denver. We went directly to the Brown Palace Hotel, where Gaylord had left word for us to come immediately to his suite of rooms. We obeyed directions and were greeted graciously by our host. He called a porter to check our trunks, and when the man returned, he knew before he accepted the checks that one was missing. My good man, you have not checked one of the trunks, he explained. The porter saw his mistake and returned later with the missing check. We boarded the train at 9 o'clock and found that he had engaged 3 adjoining drawing rooms. Gaylord excused himself almost immediately. "I wish to retire at once," he explained, "and leave my body, as I must go to Arabia for further directions. But I will be with you at breakfast." The next morning, at the first call, Gaylord, Rayborn, and I went through to the dining car. While we sat at breakfast, a dark, handsome, wiry sort of man passed our table, accompanied by a beautiful woman of striking appearance. Involuntarily, we all noticed them. We finished our breakfast and Gaylord asked us to come at once to his drawing room. "That man and woman," he explained as soon as we were seated, "are 2 of the communist representatives with whom we have to deal. We are perfectly safe because they do not know how to protect themselves nor their secrets by the power of the inner light. They do not serve the light and are therefore unable to use it as we do and so release its power. However, we must be on our guard from the start, so that at no point will they be able to sense anything of our activities. The man's companion is one of the cleverest, most dangerous, and notorious persons known in Europe. Put on your armor," he said, speaking to me, "for in handling this woman, when the time comes, you will need to use all your powers of diplomacy. You have a part to fulfill more important than you dream of. But I know your courage, poise, and assurance from the mighty I am present within. That will take you through victoriously. Through my visit to the Far East last night, it is very evident that we are getting into action here none too soon. Those who are the claws of the sinister force are already polluting and corrupting wherever possible by their deceit and treachery. Now you can realize how great was Saint Germain's wisdom in his 3 days' preparation and attunement of you while in the Cave of Symbols. You wonder that I know of the place? I have been there many times. Will you," I asked, "tell us whatever of your experiences you are permitted to reveal?" "I will be glad," he replied graciously, "to relate whatever I am permitted to reveal for your instruction and enlightenment, but not just for entertainment. We changed trains at Chicago, and after leaving there, which will be about 9 o'clock tonight, I shall be glad to visit you again. When we reach Chicago, have all the bags taken to your compartment and wait for me, as I expect to have important communications for both of you." When the train pulled into the station, Mr. Gaylord stepped off the car and disappeared immediately in the crowd. "He must have drawn the cloak of invisibility about him," I said to Rayborn. "He has gone so quickly." We changed trains and went immediately to our compartment. As the train pulled out of the station, we heard Gaylord enter his compartment. In about 10 minutes he tapped on our door and asked us to join him. "It was just as I thought," he explained. "Our adversary has a powerful tool in this city, one of the high political officials who is receiving large sums of money for the assistance he is giving to these destructive activities. However, he is under surveillance and will be taken into custody in the morning. No one will dare to announce it publicly because of others with whom he is connected and whose prominence makes it too dangerous for them to allow his name to be revealed. It is the same old story. When the battle grows too fierce in the camp of the unvirtuous, it is each man for himself, and each man's deeds trap him in his own net. The man and his companion, whom we saw at breakfast the other morning, have taken the compartment next to you," he continued, indicating me. "However, you will know exactly the right thing to do at the right moment, and I know you will do it. Now I will explain for your instruction one of my experiences that began in India, reached its height in Arabia, and finished in America. Some years ago, when the aftermath of the war was spending its fury, I was selected by the Council of the Great White Brotherhood in India to act in the capacity of messenger. This work necessitated taking my physical body with me, for at that time I was not able to levitate and transport it through the atmosphere as the ascended masters do. However, now I can leave my body, consciously, at any time, as you are both fully aware, and this good brother, indicating Rayborn, has physically observed. Obeying the call from the Council of India, I sailed for France, the first part of my journey. At that time, I was not so clearly sensitive to the finer vibratory action as I am now, and had to be led more or less intuitively. Little did I dream in those days that I was obeying as definitely as I am now. The first morning at sea, I found a most distinguished-looking gentleman seated at my table as I came down to breakfast. He arose as I approached and introduced himself. "I take the liberty of introducing myself," he said. "I trust I am not intruding." I liked him very much the moment I shook hands with him, and we chatted on generalities for a few moments, when he remarked, "I presume you are traveling for pleasure, possibly on a mission?" And as he pronounced the word mission, he looked at me very sharply. Instantly, I felt something tighten within, and I was on guard at once. "I enjoy water travel very much," I replied, "especially in the month of May." A slight smile passed over his face, and an amused look came into his eyes. Still, the feeling that I liked him grew stronger, and somehow I could not help it nor explain the cause. Suddenly he shifted the conversation, began speaking of a certain young prince, and asked if I had met him. "Only as a small child," I replied, "but I have always felt he was a great soul." "Just what do you mean by that?" he asked. "I mean he is one who has lived many lives and attained certain inner knowledge through much experience," I replied. "Then you believe in re-embodiment?" he questioned again. "I not only believe it, but I know it to be true, and a certain phase of one activity of the great cosmic law," I answered. "You speak with great assurance," he continued. "In this respect, I speak from actual knowledge," I retorted.
"Oh, you do?
Now, for instance, do you think you and I have ever met before?" he went on. And there was a sort of quizzical, half-teasing note in his voice, yet a loving kindness in its quality, that denied any real opposition to my thought. "Yes," I continued, "we knew each other before the last cataclysm on Atlantis and also in Egypt. Now we have met again and shall work together many times for our mutual good." I spoke with an inner impelling power and a feeling of authority that amazed me. I was surprised at my own words. He extended his hand, looked at me with a smile that would have melted anyone, and gave me a sign which I knew came only from one of very high authority in the Great White Brotherhood. I was deeply grateful and very happy. "You passed the test splendidly, my brother," he explained, "and it is well you are on guard so naturally. This makes it possible for the inner presence to act at all times. Remember, the mighty I Am Presence is the only power which can guard you in the outer activity, for it cannot be done by the personal will. Never fail to maintain this continual guard, for it is imperative in the work you are to do. The great life stream and plan of our work has brought us together for the next few months. Your I Am Presence spoke the truth about our having been together in former lives. I rejoice, as I see you do also, that our outer activity unites us again at the present time. Let us go to my cabin, and I will give you some idea of our work. You will receive further instruction in detail from the Council in India." As we entered his cabin, I felt a sense of exquisite beauty about everything around him. I did not know then, as I have learned since, that it was not so much the furnishings as the wondrous radiance he shed over them. His blazing aura penetrated, charged, and illumined everything in the room. "The first important thing I have to tell you," he explained, "is that I am detailed With your assistance to prevent the assassination of the young prince we mentioned some time ago, whom we both love because of his inner light. The second duty is to prevent a great indignity to Arabia by certain European powers. The third thing is the activity of the sinister force with which we are dealing now. We shall stop 2 days in Paris as we pass through France, and there shall make important contacts to help us accomplish our work. The days passed all too rapidly while I was in association with this remarkable man, and the only promise he exacted from me at any time was when he introduced himself by requesting that I never reveal his name to anyone. I have never done so to this day, and never shall, except with his permission. I thought at the time, when I saw him perform what the world calls miracles, that he was the most wonderful person in the world. But he revealed only a fragmentary part of his knowledge and power at that time. When I mentioned these things to him, he replied, "This sort of activity is the least important work the members of the Great White Brotherhood are able to do. In fact, there is nothing they cannot do when necessity and the divine law permit." The boat arrived at Cherbourg, and as we disembarked I saw a man who looked like an Arab give my friend the sign of the White Brotherhood, which he answered. The Arab led us to a magnificent auto that we entered at once, he taking the wheel. Inside the car sat a closely veiled woman to whom I was presented, not by name, but as the brother from the far west of America, and she merely as sister of the White Brotherhood. As nearly as I could see and sense, she seemed very young, not more than 17 years of age. We were hardly seated when she said, "We can reach Paris much more quickly this way," indicating a road into which we turned immediately. "We are being followed," she warned a moment later, and looking around we saw another car following at full speed. At once there arose from the ground a wall of vapor between the two cars. "They will not pass that barrier until we are well out of their reach," she assured us. We arrived in Paris a few hours later and stopped at an old castle-like residence from which we could see dimly the Eiffel Tower. It was situated high up, and from its many windows one had almost a complete bird's-eye view of the city. It seemed as if it had been built for that purpose in the first place. The veiled lady led the way through the entrance and up a grand staircase. We entered what looked like an audience chamber and, passing through a side door, came into a large library. A tall, handsome man, turning from one of the bookcases, came forward and greeted us with a courtly grace that is not the custom of our time. Later I realized why. He was one of the great ascended masters who had made his ascension more than 500 years ago. His eyes sparkled with kindness and a wisdom that seemed as old as eternity. The veiled lady who had accompanied us, he explained, was his daughter in a former life and a pupil of his in this one. She had been in the ascended state more than 300 years, yet she looked not over 17. I can never tell you the effect those experiences had on me. Every new revelation stirred a feeling within that I never knew existed. "My beloved friends," our host said as soon as we had been presented and greetings had been exchanged, "please be seated. Luncheon will be served immediately, and afterwards I will convey the instruction which I am to give you." A few moments later, two youths in cream-colored robes appeared and served our meal. It was very delicious. It was the same kind of precipitated food that we have all been privileged to eat at St. Germain's retreat in the Cave of Symbols. "Tonight," said our host, "you are to be my guests, together with 8 of the brothers who will be here to meet our American brother. They know him, but as yet he has not recalled the memory of them." Promptly, at 8 o'clock, our host led the way to the top floor, and we entered a circular room where everything was decorated in soft milk-white color. In the center stood a white onyx table, and around it had been placed 12 chairs. We stood for a moment, one at each corner of the table, with heads bowed, and when we looked up, the 8 brothers were there in living, tangible bodies. I was presented to each in turn, and then the group sat down. They all knew my friend of steamship acquaintance very well. Many problems of national and international importance were brought up for solution, and in every case a real remedy, worthy of their time and attention, was found to meet the requirements. It was during this time I learned that our host was chief of the Council of France, although he was not a Frenchman. Each brother was given specific direction, which it became his duty to carry out. As the council adjourned, everyone said goodbye with the blessing, "We enfold you in the potent power of the magic I am presence, to whom all brothers of the great white brotherhood look and receive without limit." We bowed our heads, and the brothers disappeared as silently as they had come. We bowed our host good night and were shown to our rooms. We had breakfast early the next morning and were ready to leave by 9 o'clock, the veiled lady accompanying us as before. We arrived at the docks in Marseille just in time to ask God's blessings upon our fair sister and take our leave. We boarded the steamer, and I asked my friend why I felt such an attraction to the veiled lady and what was the meaning of it, for she seemed always before my vision and about me ever since we had entered the automobile in Paris. "Have patience," he answered. "You will soon know." Our cabins adjoined, and we settled down to enjoy our trip on the Mediterranean to the full. We were bound for Bombay by way of the Suez Canal and the Red Sea, with visits to Alexandria and Cairo. It was a trip one could not forget in 1,000 years. Not a single thing occurred to mar its beauty and our joy, and being extremely fond of water travel, I reveled in my newly found happiness. As our boat came alongside the pier at Bombay, I was intensely interested, for this was my first trip to that part of the world. Since those years, the Orient has become quite familiar. I had expected that we would make the last portion of our journey by train, but to my surprise, we had scarcely left the gangplank when a handsome young Hindu dressed in white approached. He gave us a sign we knew so well and led us to a large, beautiful auto. He opened the door in quiet dignity and waited for us to enter. To my astonishment, within the car sat another veiled lady, who looked very like the one we had left in France. To my intellect, that seemed impossible, so I put it out of my mind. I was presented to her in a similar manner as to the other lady. It was not long until our fair companion answered my thought with the question, "Why, my good brother, should we think anything impossible where the understanding of the individual is complete?" "My good sister," I replied, "you are so like a lovely lady we met in Paris that I can hardly believe you are not the same person. Yet we left her there, so she could not be here." "You think not?" she questioned again, and my friend suggested, "We had better watch the beautiful scenery, for we may not pass this way again." It was 10 o'clock in the morning when we left Bombay. We drove until 6 in the evening, and by that time had reached a quiet little city. We drove to a large native residence. The man in white driving the auto waited for us to alight, and then drove away immediately. Again our veiled sister led the way to the dwelling. A stately, white-haired English lady with a youthful face and figure opened the door. "Welcome, my good sisters and brothers," she said, greeting us cordially. "I was anticipating your arrival. Your rooms are ready, and the attendant will show you to them, if you care to refresh yourselves after so long a drive. Dinner will be served in 20 minutes. Presently the soft tones of a bell announced the meal, and we proceeded to the dining room. Imagine my feelings as we met at dinner when I found that the veiled sister who had driven with us from Bombay was the same lady we had met in Paris. As soon as I saw who she was, I greeted her with, "My beloved." I had no intention of saying any such thing, and felt greatly chagrined and confused. I apologized profusely, tried to restrain an almost irresistible impulse to talk. She did not seem to mind the familiarity in the least, but replied, "I deeply appreciate your sincere greeting." I managed to collect my thoughts enough to ask, "Will you please tell me how you were able to reach India before us?" "I have a means of transportation," she explained, "with which you are not familiar. However, you will be taught to travel as I do. We are able to transport our bodies to any distance we desire without using any physical conveyance." The next morning, we were on our way at daybreak. The day was very warm outside, but within the auto it was comfortably cool and delightful. Deliciously cool drinks were always provided for us. We had been driving in the mountains for some time and were climbing steadily when we entered a deep gorge, walls rising at least 2,000 feet on each side. It looked as if a giant fissure had been cut through the mountains for nearly a mile. We drove through this crevasse and came out into a basin about 4 miles in circumference, surrounded by towering peaks. Never before or since have I ever seen a more beautiful spot on earth. It was a perfect paradise. On the west side of this basin, facing east, stood a magnificent palace of white marble, unlike any building I have ever seen in the outer world. Saint Germain has not said so, but I have always thought it was a precipitated substance. A large golden dome covered the central portion of the roof, and there were 4 smaller domes, one on each corner. When the morning sun flashed upon these domes, the whole scene became an indescribable blaze of glory, a daily silent symbol and acknowledgment by nature of the great light and wisdom that poured out constantly upon the earth from this temple of beauty. We drove to the eastern entrance of this magnificent palace, and 2 youths in snow-white garments came out to greet us. They were the picture of perfect health, youth, and beauty. Their hair was especially attractive, one being a soft, wavy brown, and the other a most wonderful gold. The latter welcomed us. "Beloved sister and brothers, you are expected and most welcome. Will you please follow me?" We entered and were greeted again by one of the ascended masters who is greatly beloved in the outer world, and who has worked ceaselessly for many centuries to bring enlightenment to the race of mankind. He has a very kindly face, a smile that would melt a heart of stone, and makes one feel at once that he wields a power that solves all things. Other attendants came forward in graceful rhythmic motion and led the way to our rooms. The interior design and furnishing of this palace were exquisitely beautiful. Since my first visit to that wonderful spot, it has been my duty as well as my pleasure to contact many important places throughout the world because of the work of the Great White Brotherhood with which I have been associated. But even the most elaborate have never approached the exquisite perfection of this white marble palace of the Ascended Masters. The whole interior of this wonderful building was made of an imperishable material, milk-white in color, with here and there touches of a very delicate gold, violet, green, and an intense electric blue. This produced the most artistic effect imaginable. Everything remained immaculately clean because within and around the building all was so powerfully charged with electronic force, and the vibratory rate was so high that the power of the light repelled everything imperfect and kept all in a self-sustained state of beauty and perfection. "Dinner will be served in your rooms," explained the youth with the golden hair, "and you are requested to wear the silken robes and sandals that will be provided. When the dinner arrived, it consisted of several kinds of fresh fruit, among them berries, served with a substance like whipped cream, similar to that which we had eaten in the cave of Symbols, and a delicious drink of golden liquid a little less heavy than honey. As soon as we had finished our repast, we were summoned to the council chamber under the central dome. On entering, the great table in the middle of the room caught the eye at once, because of its massive size. It was made entirely of jade, heavily veined in gold, exquisitely beautiful in even the smallest detail, and around it had been placed 60 chairs, made of solid gold, and upholstered in a fabric of soft violet color that looked like silk velvet. We stood a moment, admiring the beauty and perfection of it all, and as we looked around saw Saint Germain. The entire council entered in little groups of 3 to 12, when all but one had arrived and taken their places around the table. Our beloved master spoke. "Let us bow our heads in silent praise and gratitude to the mighty I Am Presence which is lifting the hearts and illumining the minds of mankind." As we raised our heads, a most marvelous being stood in the place that had been left vacant at the head of the table. He was one of the great ascended masters to whom it is impossible to do full justice, because the great majesty and authority to which he has attained surpass all human powers of description. His robes looked like a glittering mass of jewels, but as I became more accustomed to the brilliancy of his light, I saw that what looked like jewels at first were points of dazzling radiance emanating from his body and robes. The love he poured forth was so all-encompassing that it seemed to flood the universe, so far-reaching was its scope. "Beloved sisters and brothers of the Great White Brotherhood, I greet you," he said, giving the sign of the order that acknowledges only the omniscience of the mighty I Am Presence, the omnipresence of the undying flame of life, and the omnipotence of the shadowless light. "My brother from America, I bid you welcome. Please accept my love and gratitude for the service you have performed. I shall speak with you at length at the close of the meeting." This mighty brother of light proceeded to give definite instruction concerning the most important activities of the earth, principally the inner and outer changes that needed to be brought about for humanity's advancement. Many of the councils from all over the world were represented by those present. The chief of each council received orders direct from the presiding master and gave his directions to the ones under him. When the outline of their activities was finished, he asked each one to turn his chair about and face the west. In the atmosphere before us began to pass living pictures of the problems the Great White Brotherhood held under consideration or were working on at the time. They showed the individual brothers who were concerned with them and would continue to work on special assignments, giving the principal details and means of solution. The work of protecting the young prince previously referred to and the brothers who were concerned with it was one of the many scenes that passed before our vision. The method for readjusting conditions pertaining to Arabia was also shown and excited my admiration greatly. When the greater problem of dealing with the sinister force which is trying to keep humanity from recognizing and manifesting the perfection and blessing of the mighty I Am Presence was revealed, it was the most astonishing thing anyone can imagine. It really showed the unlimited force of the cosmic Christ light dealing with darkness, and no words can portray the majesty, power, and victory of the presence of the infinite I Am. At the present, I may give no further details, but the glory and supremacy in action of the mighty presence of the infinite I Am transcends all imagination, just as light transcends darkness. The pictures came to an end, and the presiding master, he of the dazzling radiance, turned to the sister from France and myself. "Come, my beloved children," he said. We stepped forward, and he extended both hands, his left one to her, and his right to me. "My brother from America," he went on, "I bless you exceedingly. You have not yet realized the eternal perfection that is now yours in the outer activity. Our beloved sister is your twin ray. This is one of the greatest of God's mysteries, and explains the mutual attraction between you since your first meeting in Paris. If the humanity of Earth could have the God understanding of this part of the divine plan, it would do more to purify the chaos of the outer world than any other thing. Time is nearing when the truth concerning the twin rays must be thoroughly understood, and its mighty wisdom and power utilized. No individualization of God does creative work at cosmic levels in the fullness of the mighty I Am presence until that one's twin ray has made the ascension. Earthly choice has nothing whatsoever to do with it. Each ray must, by conscious understanding and the use of the great command, purify, perfect, and illumine all the human creation by which it has surrounded itself. It then becomes the ascended master, who forever has conscious dominion over the earth and all that is therein. When both rays have made the ascension, they are of the same state of purity, freedom, and perfect dominion. The two are then able to work at cosmic levels. There they can project great cosmic rays of love, light, and wisdom, focusing them with such power that they create and control cosmic activities and reveal the great glory of the mighty I Am presence. Our beloved sister has seen and known of this for some time, patiently awaiting this divine moment. After the raising of your body, your work together will be very transcendent. He raised his hands above us in blessing, and his voice, beautiful as a bell, with a tone of eternal authority, uttered the supreme decree of love everlasting upon their union. By the command of the mighty I Am presence, I join these twin rays of the eternal flame of life in supreme love, light, and perfection. As the Master said these words, a dazzling shaft of light enveloped us, and in this the mighty flame of our twin rays set its eternal seal upon our cosmic pathway of life. In that moment, we were fully conscious of ourselves as only that magic presence of the I Am. This closed the council meeting, and in the hour that followed, we met the members of that retreat and received their congratulations. They assured us that our unlimited cosmic service would now begin. The next day, the Master, who was our host, explained some of their work and revealed the perfection that had been maintained there for centuries. In explaining the origin of their work, he said, "This Council of the Great White Brotherhood was created centuries ago by the Great Brothers of Light, that a powerful focus of their help and illumination to humanity might be brought about and perpetuated for a definite period of time. The wonderful semi-tropical climate you find here will last as long as we desire to retain this place as a retreat." That evening, we were shown the perfected instrument for television in operation. I could not help remarking what glories and marvels humanity could and would experience if it would only reach up consciously and sincerely to the inner light, and the individuals open their hearts and feelings to the mighty magic presence of the I Am. Early the following morning, we returned to Bombay, whence we were to sail for Arabia. The trip to the coast was delightful, the atmosphere in the car always remaining cool and comfortable, no matter how warm it became outside. I knew this was due entirely to the deep understanding of my beloved and my friend. We went back to Bombay by an entirely different route from the one by which we had come. The following morning, we sailed on a small boat for Egypt, stopping at the port we wished to reach on the west coast of Arabia. When it reached the Red Sea, as we began to sail north on its placid waters, my friend suddenly became charged by the electronic force so powerfully that we all noticed it. "For some reason," he said, "I have contacted the period in which Moses led the children of Israel through this sea, for the living pictures are all appearing before me here in the etheric records. What a time of wonders that was in the midst of such a very great distress. Moses truly made a most wonderful contact with the ascended masters, who were assisting and who wielded tremendous power through him to accomplish that undertaking. I see for the first time the great ascended master to whom Moses knowingly addressed his petition at that time for help. The majesty and power of that mighty being can scarcely be comprehended by the human mind. So marvelously does it transcend the ordinary experience of humanity. How little the modern world knows, realizes, or credits those marvels actually performed by such wonderful servants of God for the enlightenment and uplift of mankind. These stupendous so-called miracles are, after all, only the activity of a law that humanity has not yet tried to study or understand. When one speaks in terms of universal truth, there is no such thing in infinite creation as a miracle, for what the world calls miracles are only the operation of divine law, which because of its very nature of perfection sets aside all humanly established laws of limitation. It is to bring the full understanding of the operation of divine law into the minds of the children of earth that the ascended masters have labored in the past, and for which they still do labor unceasingly with the inhabitants of this planet. Today, all unknown to the outer world, there are still more wonderful things being done than in those days of long ago. So far as this vast, deeper knowledge and power is concerned, the majority of mankind are but babes. However, the hour is rapidly approaching when humanity must awaken to the all-encompassing inner presence of God, acting through the individual. At last, the boat stopped at our seaport on the coast of the province of Hejaz, a sort of peninsula jutting out into the northeast edge of the Red Sea. We landed at this quaint place, and again were given the secret sign by a tall, slender Arab in spotless white garments, who stood beside a large, powerful auto, opening the door for us to enter. Without a word, we were driven away at unusual speed over a hard, sandy highway. There were lovely refreshments already provided within the car. Late in the afternoon, we entered a small mountain village and drove up to a low, snow-white house. Our silent Arab guide opened the door and motioned us to enter. He knocked upon an inner door that was opened immediately by a white-haired elderly gentleman with brown skin and very kindly eyes. "Sister and brothers," was his greeting, "you are expected. Refresh yourselves, and food will be served as soon as you are ready. After nightfall, a brother will call and take you to your destination. I trust the brotherhood will not fail in their assistance to our country." I was about to speak when my beloved grasped my arm firmly. I understood her signal and kept silent. "The light of God never fails," my friend answered our host, in a voice that made the very air tremble, so great was the power and truth with which his spoken word was charged, and so definitely did he utter that almighty decree. The effect was like magic. The old man fell on his knees and bowed his head to the ground before my friend. At 9 o'clock, a handsome young man wearing the native white Arab dress over which was thrown a long indigo cape appeared at the door. "Friends of the West," he said, "come. The way is open." We followed immediately without a word. We walked a short distance and found camels waiting. We mounted silently and set off at great speed toward a high mountain. Later I learned that these were the famous racing camels, and the one on which my beloved was mounted was snow white. We sped along in silence for nearly 2 hours, and then came to a hut made of heavy stone and set close against the mountain. As we dismounted, a man appeared from out of the darkness to care for the camels. Our guide entered the hut and motioned us to follow. We reached the opposite side of the room, and he raised his hands and placed them against the wall. They at once became a blazing light, so great was the power he directed. They were as dazzling as an electric light bulb, only much whiter. He pressed a certain section of the wall, and it turned on a pivot, disclosing an opening into a tunnel of intense white light. We stepped into this, and the opening closed behind us. We followed him for several hundred feet and came to a metal door. Our guide placed his hand upon a certain symbol on it, and the door, weighing many tons, fully 8 inches thick, opened slowly, and we entered a long, narrow room whose walls, ceiling, and floor were all made of untarnishable steel. In a few moments a door opened in one wall, where an instant before none could be seen, and a man entered, motioning us to follow him. With our guide still leading the way, we went some distance, and at last came to another solid wall. It opened at our approach and admitted us into a marvelous chamber, fully 100 feet long and about 40 feet wide, furnished in a most extraordinary manner, but artistic, exquisite, and beautiful as a dream. In the center of the floor was a great circle, enclosing a marvelous zodiac, and around this had been placed large soft cushions for 28 persons. Our guide stepped to a room at one side of the great chamber, asking us to follow. Within was a sparkling bath, beside which lay robes and sandals provided for our use. "When you are ready, send me your thought," said our guide, and left us. We finished our preparation and sent the mental message as requested, and immediately an attendant appeared with delicious refreshments. We finished our meal and then re-entered the great council hall, where 24 of the sisters and brothers had already assembled. Our guide presented us to the members, and all took their places around the circle. To my amazement, I discovered that the brother who had acted as our guide was none other than the chief of the Council of Arabia, a great ascended master of whom I had heard many times. He rose, gave the invocation, and addressed the assembly. Because of the unusual agitation, he explained, in the political circles of Arabia at the present moment, great secrecy has been imperative in bringing outside members into these councils. That is why there has been a constant watchfulness on our part while our visiting members have been en route. Matters of grave importance were presented for the discussion, especially the one nearest to the hearts of these people. The chief directed their attention to my friend. "This brother," he said, "holds a solution to the problem concerning our beloved land of Arabia," and he asked him to present it. My friend outlined his plan briefly, and when he had finished, everyone in the room except our chief was surprised at his daring and ingenuity. The chief smiled reassuringly and continued, "The plan is feasible, remarkable as it is. It shall be carried out quickly and successfully. The entire great white brotherhood of the earth will watch over the meeting that is about to take place, and you can rest assured this plan will be set into operation at once. The sister and brothers who have come under special guard are to rest here tonight and tomorrow. On the third day, I will go with them to the British consulate where our negotiations will take place." A wave of joy swept over the whole meeting as this outline of their work was finished. Other matters concerning their various activities were disposed of, and the meeting came to an end, the members disappearing one by one. The chief then arose and came to where we sat. "Beloved sister and brothers," he said, "I did not reveal myself to you at first for reasons that you will soon learn. I welcome you with great joy to this retreat of the Great White Brotherhood. All is at your service. Brother from the West, retire to your quarters and sleep until you are called." I awakened 12 hours later at the signal, feeling like a new person, so charged was I with new life and light. "I think you will be interested in this retreat," our host said, "to learn something of its history and the part it plays as a center of power on this earth. It is one of the oldest foci of spiritual power on this planet. You have only seen a fragment of it so far. A year from now, a great council of the White Brotherhood is to be held here. At that time, each member will be shown through this vast unknown citadel. He spent a long time showing us their tremendous accumulation of records, which they have preserved for the enlightenment of humanity. It was truly a privilege to be shown these treasures hour after hour. You will leave here at 2 o'clock, he explained. Go now and put on your garments of the outer world, for by then it will be time to proceed to where the camels are waiting at our entrance. We obeyed, and when we returned, found the chief dressed in a beautiful blue flannel suit, wearing a long indigo cloak over it. Except for the marvelous texture of his skin and the brilliant, piercing, loving light in his eyes, one might easily have thought him to be a man who belonged to the outer world of business. Why may I not look like yourselves, he remarked, as he saw my thought. I am an individual like yourselves, only of greater experience and wisdom, which I have applied longer. That is all. Wisdom is of no benefit to anyone unless it is used, and through that use, the individual manifests perfection so he can live above every limitation. By this time we had reached the gate where the camels were waiting. When all were mounted, we sped through the night with the wonderful white camel always leading the way. We made even greater speed than before because we arrived at the hut, the starting place of this particular part of our journey, at 3:30. The auto was waiting, and just as we entered, the driver said something to the master that I did not hear. Have no fear, the chief replied. We shall draw the cloak of invisibility about ourselves and the car, and pass them unnoticed. Let us proceed. Spies, he explained to us, have been stationed along this road to seize the car and prevent anyone from discovering us afterward. The right use of knowledge, which is true wisdom, always sets us free, as you will soon observe. It was not long until we approached the spot where the spies had been placed, and in an instant a dense white vapor rose all around us like a fog, enveloping the machine completely. A peculiar whirring like the sound of an airplane was heard overhead, and while the guards were looking up to find the source of it, we shot by silently like an arrow. It was a marvelous experience for me, because while we could see them through the cloak of invisibility from within, those on the outside could not and did not see us. How is it, I asked, that they did not seem to hear us? Sound, he explained, does not penetrate the cloak of invisibility. Otherwise it would be of no use to us. The tales of the Arabian Nights, my brother, are only too true, for when really understood they are revelations of divine law, instead of the silly literal interpretation that the outer world in its smug ignorance has chosen to place upon them. They are not folklore for children, but inner intimations of the accomplishments that are perfectly possible when the student is sincere, worthy, and humble enough to be trusted with the power and truth that they reveal. The great monster, doubt, and his nefarious associates, ignorance, pride, ridicule, skepticism, fear, and many other useless barnacles, have so fastened themselves upon the mentality and feelings of humanity that they have become like fungi hanging from a tree and rotting its trunk. If it were not for these vampires, mankind would see and know that within the very light that animates the physical body exists an intelligence and power that can and will carry out perfectly whatever the mind directs, when harmony is maintained and all direction is constructive. Love, wisdom, and power are the primal attributes which life uses to build a permanent creation. And when mankind ceases its self-created discord, all life around it and in nature will express permanent perfection. We drove along the seacoast on a splendid highway, and at last entered the city that was our destination. We registered at the best hotel, and early the next morning called at the British Consulate. My friend said he had been sent as a representative of the Arabian government to present a certain solution for the impending crisis, which he trusted would satisfy all concerned and prevent a very great injustice and indignity to Arabia. The British consul asked for his credentials, and instead of presenting them himself, the chief of the Arabian council stepped forward and presented them in his stead. An appointment was made to meet with the British representatives at 11 o'clock, and we returned promptly at that hour. After the conference had progressed with its usual method of suavely yet persistently shelving everything that did not give them the best of the arrangement, my friend at the opportune moment arose and presented the proposal of the Arabian government. He was calm, masterful, and kindly, yet everyone realized unmistakably that he was somehow in command of the situation, and that all the dignity and power of the conference had centered itself around him. His opponents were not just altogether comfortable. He was too keen and honest for their usual method of diplomatic fencing, but somehow they could not present their ideas in a very favorable light in the face of his frank scrutiny and open kindness. They played for time by various kinds of strategy, when suddenly I was conscious of the entire conference being held within a great circle of blazing light, so bright it seemed to me everyone must see it. Then I realized what a gigantic focus of power the Great White Brotherhood had directed into that room. Less than an hour later, my friend's solution was accepted, the documents drawn up, and signed by both parties, and the meeting adjourned in peace and happiness. The news flashed quickly throughout Arabia, and there was great rejoicing. As we returned to the hotel, my beloved came forward to greet us. "Noble brother, I congratulate you," she said, "on your dignity and splendid accomplishment." The next day, the chief of the council of Arabia bade my beloved and me goodbye, and we boarded the steamer returning to France. That evening, we sailed on the Mediterranean under a full moon. To me, it was the most peaceful night I ever experienced. We landed at Marseille, left immediately by train for Paris, and spent the night with the wonderful master who was chief of the council of the Great White Brotherhood in France. The following morning he drove with us to Cherbourg. Here we said goodbye to my beloved, whom I was not to see until years later. When we next met, it was never to part again. We boarded a liner for New York, and that voyage stands out as one of the most remarkable of my entire life, for my wonderful friend taught me the most marvelous use of the ancient wisdom. He instructed me, and the results I had from the use of the great command were simply amazing. We arrived in New York and hurried at once to Washington, where my friend presented the results of the Arabian matter to the president and his cabinet. The news had already preceded his arrival. That ended my first personal contact and observation of the stupendous and marvelous activity of the Great White Brotherhood. As Gaillard finished relating his experiences, we saw daylight just breaking on the eastern horizon. "Let us go to your drawing room," he said, referring to me, "for one of the ascended masters has much to do in the work we are to accomplish next. The lady and gentleman, who are but pawns of the sinister force, have in their possession certain documents and records which they have stolen. These papers contain information we need, which they intend to use against innocent people for blackmail purposes. We must have that information in order to protect others whom they seek to injure, and to bring into their clutches through the power of fear." We then returned to my compartment. I wondered what Mr. Gaillard intended to do next. We waited a few moments and soon heard the man and woman go into the dining car. "Now, watch carefully," said Gaillard, "and do not move or speak while I am operating." We sat down, and he focused his attention upon the door that led into their compartment. In a moment he directed a ray of electronic light upon it. He steadily increased the power, and we were unable to look within the room. A traveling bag lay upon one of these seats. Gaylord held the force steadily until he saw what it contained. The expression on his face indicated he had found the information for which he was searching, and in an instant he released the power and said, "In 3 days, they will be ready for the proper authorities to welcome them to a long rest from any further activity of that kind. With those papers in their possession, it makes their escape impossible. In this case, the newspapers will not be able to break through the wall of secrecy and invisibility of the Ascended Masters, who control all human law by the one eternal law of divine justice." Saint Germain had indicated the hotel in Washington where we were to stay, and when we arrived, he welcomed us in person. His appearance was changed so that he did not attract undue attention. "My beloved brother," he said as he went up to Gaylord, "I do sincerely congratulate you and give praise and thanks for your splendid success, because you have broken the backbone of a very destructive activity, at least so far as that group is concerned." Turning to Rayburn and me, he greeted us in that loving, gracious manner that is such a distinguishing characteristic of all Ascended Masters, and particularly of Saint Germain. "May I have the privilege of providing you breakfast?" he said. "I trust it will be quite satisfying and delicious. Will you come to my rooms?" After breakfast, he suggested that we retire and get our much-needed rest. Yet while in his marvelous presence, we were never conscious of needing rest. The third day after our arrival, Rayburn, Gaylord, and I, accompanied by Saint Germain and certain members of the Secret Service, went to the rendezvous of an important group of those who were willing channels for the sinister force. There were present the 7 principal leaders in America. We reached the place and stood for a moment outside their rooms. We could hear an excited discussion going on in undertones as we approached the door. Suddenly it burst open and we walked in upon them, Saint Germain charging the atmosphere with an electronic force that held them immovable. Their drawn guns dropped to the floor where they stood, and their arms hung motionless by their sides. Saint Germain raised his right hand, made the sign of cosmic protection and power, and in a voice that penetrated every atom, even of the building itself, uttered the eternal fiat of truth, before which all destructive forces bow and are forever silenced. "Tell those who have been associated with you and all who come after you that the light of God never fails." As his voice carried that decree into their consciousness, they turned ashen with fear from their own creation, and their bodies shook like leaves in the wind. The members of the Secret Service stepped forward and took them into custody, where they shall remain until they serve the light.